Chateau Morissette is Virginia's oldest winery. It's located on the Blue Ridge Parkway, 3,500 feet above sea level, an hour from Roanoke and 2 hours from Greensboro, North Carolina. When the Morissette family opened their Floyd, Virginia winery back in 1978, it was the only one in the state. Today, there are more than 288 Virginia wineries, but the vast majority are small-lot boutique producers with total average annual production of less than 2,000 cases. At Chateau Morissette, it was a long and painful road discovering the ideal grape varieties and perfecting their wine processing. But today, they annually produce more than 75,000 cases with distribution to 9 states and overseas to China. Morissette produces a broad array of wines. A sampler of their reds include Pinot Noir and Petit Verdot. Their sweet and blushes include Vin Gris and Red and White Muscadine. Sweet fruit wines include cherry, blackberry, and apple. And they offer a sparkling wine and a range of whites from Chardonnay to Viognier. Come along and join David Morissette as he shares his family's incredible winemaking and grape-growing journey and their parallel evolution into the culinary scene with their estate restaurant that has specialized in farm-to-table, locally-sourced organic offerings since long before the hip restaurant phrase became a trend. David Morissette. I'm Tom Wilmer. We're here with David Morissette in Virginia. And David and his family are the pioneers of modern wine producing in the state. What a pleasure to finally meet you in person.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you. I'm glad that you could join us here.
So in a way, you're kind of the accidental tourist. You didn't start out wanting to be a winemaker or a wine grower.
No, we didn't. My mother and father actually started this in the mid-70s, and we jokingly say that we had to start a winery because our family drank so much. But we just have a love for agriculture and land preservation. And my parents started growing grapes and making wine, and I was going to architecture school and switch gears into winemaking.
So back in the 70s, this was a stab in the dark, wasn't it, as to what they would plant and what would work? How did they even figure out their beginnings?
Well, we were told we were crazy by many, many people. My parents planted varieties that consultants from larger grape-growing states suggested. They were failures. They didn't work. All climatical reasons, 37 below zero, one winter, which is not normal, but we do get 5 and 10 below zero here. We had to learn over and over again. Our vineyard here is probably the most expensive vineyard in Virginia because it's been replanted 5 times.
So a long, painful learning curve.
Absolutely. Very, very much painful. Painful and expensive learning curve, but it's turned out to be worth it.
So when did things start turning around for you as a wine grower and a winemaker?
Well, as you said, you know, we were the pioneers. We were the oldest winery in Virginia, licensed in 78. People never in Virginia, or especially in this rural area, never heard of wineries. They've never heard of wine, and we had to educate people, and we slowly developed a following here. Once you get a certain size winery, you have to start distributing them. And we created a sweet wine. By luck, my parents planted a grape I'd never heard of. I fermented Chardonnays because that's all I drank. It was terrible, and I put sugar in it, and we sold out in the mine. And I knew immediately what we needed to do and make sweet wines, and the sweet wines allow us to make the really high-end wines.
It's interesting dynamic because what you and I might prefer as our own drinking wine, you can't do that.
No, no. I mean, the vast amount of Americans, they talk dry, but they drink sweet wines. They don't know that the wines may have sugar in them. I think we make a wine for every person that comes in the door here, and it's our place to educate people. You only get one chance for an impression, and we're here to make memories for people, and we want that memory of the wines to carry over to where they live and where they'll just develop a following where they'll buy the wines in the stores. But it's been a long, long time coming to get to 288 wineries in the state.
So that's where you are today.
About 288. It changes every week.
Tell us about the breadth and what is happening today in Virginia at the other wineries. Where are they going? Where are their successes?
because of our size, we distribute. So we're in 9 states and sell internationally to China. A lot of the other wineries are smaller. They sell the wine out of their store, out of the winery, or at festivals. There are different wine festivals year-round that a lot of them can sell at.
So you're saying the majority would be boutique wineries?
I would think 90% of them are. Yeah, there are some that are, I mean, you know, Donald Trump has a winery here now, who he bought from the Kluges, who are their very well-known name. Founder of AOL has a winery here now, and I mean, it goes on and on. And the owner of the Washington Redskins has a winery. They do it because it's fun, it's game, and all that. You know, they like to have their name on the bottles and things like that. But the majority of them, they're very small, and they want to stay that way. And it does make life simpler, because the larger you get, you have to distribute, and you have a little more employment. But
are there guys who can be successful, even at a small case production level, not doing sweet wines, doing the dry and doing more French style?
There are. I think it would have to find a really special niche, because generally the smaller the winery, the more the cost per bottle. We have wines that are $45 a bottle and $30, but you know, we don't sell those by the case every single day. A lot of the wineries have gone into the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area to sell wine and have been successful with selling wines there.
Give us a hit list of the signature wines of Virginia today.
I mean the wineries?
The wines, the type of wines. When people say Virginia wine, what do they think of?
Well, the state is promoting. They're saying Cabernet Franc and Viognier. I'm not in a complete agreement with that, but what's been amazing is to see in the past 10 to 15 years the development of the red wines. That's where even I would question whether we could produce ones that were stand up against other ones and would have long-term aging ability. And they've proven that they can.
That they can.
Absolutely. I mean, Tanat, which is just an amazing wine, grape, that we've only made it twice. And it was $45 a bottle because of the price of the grape.
Right.
It's so expensive and it's so rare to get. But it's just beautiful wine. But the Cabernet Franc, but I also think Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnays are really great.
So Chardonnay, as I remember, has been a big seller for you, right?
Yes. In the past have made several styles. One was kept in stainless steel. It's lighter, crisper. And that's where the market had been for the past 7 or 8 years. My personal preference was one that was fermented in Asian French oak, primarily Limousin oak. The French oaks have a tighter grain to them. And the wines aged differently. It takes longer. But the flavors are much more pronounced in American. When I drank a lot of wines 20-some years ago, I'd gotten to the point where I could tell which forest the wines were from, from the barrels. I don't even have a Chardonnay, so I can't do that now. But for our Chardonnay, we ferment an agent in the barrel and then do a secondary fermentation. And that gives it, a lot of people like the buttery flavor to Chardonnay. And I like it tastes almost like buttery popcorn. It sounds weird, but you know, people have all these crazy things. Oh, it tastes, you know, they name a Cabernet and it tastes like plums and this and tobacco and eucalyptus and all this other stuff. But they come up with crazy names that automatically make people think, yeah, that is what it tastes like. But I like that style of Chardonnay right now.
Let's talk about reds for a moment. And you have a real flagship red.
Yeah, we have one that's called the Black Dog. And that was created primarily because people came here and said they didn't like red wines. And we asked them why, and they said because it was sour, if they didn't know the lingo. And if they did, they said it's because of the tannins. And when the French paradox came out, you know, that red wines were great for cholesterol, et cetera, et cetera. The red wine sales just went through the roof. And we had a bunch of black dogs running around. So to stand out in the wine business, you got to be something unique. And so we have proprietary labeled names on our bottles on a lot of them, and that's where we stand out. But the Black Dogs is basically a Bordeaux blend with just like 1.2% residual sugar. You can't even taste the sugar, but it just makes it a little bit softer.
And they love it.
They love it. Absolutely love it.
And how many cases of that do you produce, the Black Dog?
I think right now about 12,000 cases of that.
I think a great story is about your blue bottle. You have this wine, and it's chugging along, and then you do a shift. Tell us about what happened.
Well, we were making Riesling, which is a German Rhine style wine, and we've had about 1,000 cases. We can sell anything in the taste room. We can sell almost Iced and Eskimo, just about. But we changed the name to Our Dog Blue to get the proprietary name and put it in the blue bottle. And in 18 months, it went to 32,000 cases.
From 10?
From 1,000.
From 1,000.
To 32,000 cases in 18 months.
So that kind of blindsided you at first, didn't it?
It did. We were very fortunate that the harvest was just coming in, and we could buy additional fruit. And the first 4 or 5 months we had passed, and we go, oh my gosh. And so we just were scrambled and bought additional fruit and to keep up with it.
And you did not shift your formula whatsoever. No. It was the same wine, right?
One over and over, and people would go, we just love the new flavor and the new taste of this one. And at first would say, explain to them it was the same, but after a while we just said, oh, we're really glad you do. And so it came out to be a little bit easier that way.
That's a great commercial success story, isn't it?
New York Times, too.
Oh, really?
Yep, and New York Times ran an article on it one time.
So, self-admittedly, you're at a point of success in your life. You're comfortable now. You're not scared. You're ahead of the curve overall. So now you have that luxury in this point in time of your life where you could dabble and you could make David wine. You could make, well, you know, your special little taste, couldn't you? Are you thinking about that? Or are you doing that?
Well, we're actually coming out with 3 ciders next spring.
But my point is, are you following your own taste, you know,
at all? I am with the beer. Because people say, what's your favorite wine? I go, well, it's got a brown bottle and red and blue and white label on the front, which means it came from St. Louis. But the Tanat would be my favorite, but it's so hard to get the fruit. That's been the struggle with the Tanat.
And you can't do that estate grown?
No, where we are, it's 3,500 feet elevation. It's just too cold. We can't even grow watermelons or pumpkins here. They won't grow through the season.
So across the road, there are vines over there. What are your estate-grown grape varietals?
Well, we have one vineyard that's right across the street. Can't see because of the fog, obviously. And that's Niagara. And that one's actually 100% Niagara now. We have another vineyard that's 8 miles from here, but it's 2,000 feet lower elevation. And that's where we have Chardonnay, Cab, Merlot, Cab Franc, and Chamberson. Because it's 2,000 feet lower elevation, the European grapes do great between like 900 to 1,500 foot elevation because it gets the airflow that you need.
As I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, the Niagara is a traditional indigenous North American grape varietal, correct?
Yeah, it's actually it's the Native American grape. The European grapes are wines that were created hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But that when Leif Erikson came to America, he named it Vinland because of all the vines on the shore and the trees. And it can handle the climate in Virginia, the humidity, which we don't have humidity here, but we do it down in the valleys and things like that. When the colonists came, by law in Virginia, they had to plant 12 vines.
As settlers?
Yes, the first settlers had to. It's by law.
Wow.
And it didn't work. Thomas Jefferson worked diligently to make wine successful at Monticello. He brought grapevines over from France over and over and over again. And because of the humidity would just rot the fruit.
Did Jefferson ever come up with a real indigenous winter for his environment?
No. Never. Never. Mm-mm. It's a nice house, though.
Yeah, it is. Well, we're running short on time, but before we go, where are you located? We're in the heart of the Blue Ridge Parkway, right?
Mm-hmm. We're actually located right on the Blue Ridge Parkway in Floyd, Virginia, about 20 minutes from the North Carolina border. The parkway is a national park. It's about a 400-mile national park that runs along the ridges of all the mountains around here.
This has been your family's winery and estate for quite a long time, and it's evolved. This is now, there's a restaurant here. We just had lunch.
Yeah, my mother and father started buying land here in the 50s, and everybody thought they were crazy, and my dad just laughed at $50 an acre. He just laughed and just bought everything that was for sale.
What did your dad do?
Well, we had a paper company based in North Carolina and catfish farms in Alabama, and then he and my mom, we had a kind of retreat family retreat here, and that's where the winery originally started up here. It's only 70 miles from where they lived in North Carolina.
So today, tell us briefly about the restaurant. This is a destination in itself, isn't
Absolutely.
It? Exclusive up the wine.
Yeah. The restaurant is the farm to table, which we've been doing forever in this area.
Before the label came along.
Before it was cool, that's all we've done. Estate gardens and organic farms all over Floyd that we buy from. And it serves unique dishes, things that you normally wouldn't find, wild boar at times. And it's just nice, clean, fresh food. We don't rely on a lot of heavy sauces. Everything's made from scratch. Nothing's store-bought or anything like that. It's become incredibly popular.
And I imagine you close in the middle of the winter?
We close the restaurant. Restaurant's only open Fridays through Sundays, January, February, March. Rest time, it's Wednesday through Sundays. Monday, Tuesday's really slow up here. This is a big second home area, so the weekend traffic's completely different than the people that come during the week.
And I bet in the heart of the summer tourist season, you get people from all around the world.
That's almost every day anyway. I love going through the parking lot, looking at the different license plates and things like that. And yeah, we've actually had three different groups of Russians here in the past 10 days,
wow.
Which is really interesting because I have 10 kids, and some of them I adopted from Russia, and they speak Russian. And so they couldn't understand the menus my kids overheard and started talking to them in Russian. They're like, wow.
That's great.
So it was pretty mm-hmm. neat. So, but it's definitely, you know, it's nice that, really cool, this is a third generation now running it, which I love to see.
Nice. David, awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. This has been a wonderful day. And briefly before we go, your total case production today?
75,000 cases.
And a website if somebody wanted to learn more?
Thedogs.com.
So we're definitely going to have waited with the dogs on the theme.
Yeah, we've pretty much taken the dogs to the limit of everything.
So yeah, it goes without saying you love dogs and you
Absolutely.
Have dogs.
Yeah, but we assume everybody else does too.
Very cool. David Marisette, thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The Underbed music was performed by four-time Grammy Award winner, North Carolina-based musician David Holt from his album Let It Slide with Sam Bush and Doc Watson.